review by the subcommittee, some portion of the subcommittee, until we have more members available. So Mr. Harlan Levy with Government Affairs, the Oregon Association of Realtors, will start out by filling us in on some 4D issues.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Harlan Levy. I am the staff attorney for the Oregon Association of Realtors. And I'm here today to talk to you about a very important issue, one that I've spent a great deal of time on in recent months, the Endangered Species Act, the 4D rules that result from that act, and how those interplay with Oregon's land use system. Now, the presentation that I'm going to give you is adopted from a presentation that I have given around the state to various local realtor boards, and it has been met with a good deal of appreciation by those boards, and I hope that this committee also appreciates what I have to say today. What I would like to do first is go into the format of this presentation. I'm going to start with an overview of the Endangered Species Act, and then go into the 4D rule itself. The 4D rule is the rule the National Marine Fisheries Service has created to protect Pacific Northwest steelhead and salmon, and the reason it's called a 4D rule is it derives from Section 4D of the Endangered Species Act. Now, you should have in front of you two handouts. I have given you a brief synopsis of my statements today in an outline format, along with several articles that I've clipped from recent months, as well as National Marine Fisheries Service's own citizen's guide to the 4D rule. This is a valuable resource, and I encourage members of the committee to read it and take note of it, because it does explain the intricacies of the rule pretty well. It also provides you with NMFS's webpage, which is www.nwr.noaa.gov, which also is a valuable resource to obtain information about this issue. First, I'd like to start with brief history of the Endangered Species Act. The Endangered Species Act was adopted in 1973 by the Congress of the United States. It passed the Senate with a vote of 92-0, with such notables as Bob Packwood and Mark Hatfield voting yes. It passed the House of Representatives by a vote of 390-12. It was signed into law on December 28, 1973 by President Nixon, who declared that, quote, "nothing is more priceless and more worthy of preservation than the rich array of animal life with which our country has been blessed." So this was a bipartisan bill. This was a bill that had very much popular support in the public, in the media, as well as in the federal government. Okay, the purpose of the Endangered Species Act is to provide a means to preserve threatened and endangered species and the ecosystems upon which they rely. That is a pretty general purpose statement, and it can be used to do a great deal of things. I want to start with a couple important definitions contained in the Act itself. An endangered species is any species which is in danger of extinction throughout all or a significant part of its range. A threatened species is any species which is likely to become an endangered species within the foreseeable future throughout all or a significant part of its range. And this distinction will become is very important when we talk about the 4D rule, and I'll tell you why in a few moments, but just remember that there is a difference between an endangered species and a threatened species. Another definition I want to talk about briefly is critical habitat, which is defined as the specific area within the geographical area occupied by the species at the time it is listed, and on which are found those physical or biological features essential to the conservation of the species. The Endangered Species Act does require that when critical habitat is designated, the secretary, either the Secretary of the Interior or the Secretary of Agriculture, go forth and do an economic analysis of what the effect would be of that designation. In this case, that was not done, And that is the cause for a lawsuit that is currently pending in the Washington District Court. Okay, a person under the Act can be just about anybody. It can be an individual, a corporation, a partnership, a trust, an association, anything. The government, the state government, the federal government, anybody, anything, any actor is going to be defined as a person under the Act. And that's very important because liability attaches to a person. So what I'm saying is just about anybody, anything, any entity that is out there could be held liable for violating the Endangered Species Act. Now, Section 4 of the Endangered Species Act deals with listing of the species. And the process is, it started by a petition to list the species, and anybody can file a petition to list the species under the Act. And then the Secretary of Commerce, through NIMS, National Marine Fisheries Service, is responsible for listing any species that spends any time in the ocean, such as salmon or steelhead. Secretary of the Interior, through U.S. Fish and Wildlife, is responsible for listing any terrestrial species or water species that spends no time in the ocean, such as the northern spotted owl or the cutthroat trout. Now, Section 4 of the Act also requires the Secretary to designate critical habitat for these species, again, after taking into consideration the economic impact of such a designation. Finally, Section 4D directs the Secretary of Commerce or Secretary of the Interior to come up with regulations he or she deems necessary and advisable for the conservation of the species. And that is what we have here. We have 4D rules that derive from Section 4D of the Endangered Species Act. I'm going to talk briefly about Section 7 of the Act, which deals with requirements for federal agencies. Anytime a federal agency wants to do anything by itself or is required to issue a permit to a private party, it triggers Section 7, and there has to be a consultation with either NIMS or U.S. Fish and Wildlife if there is a listed species present. And that is why critical habitat is so important, because you can see the geographic area of this rule is so huge. It deals with just about half of the state, and Section 7 consultations are going to be triggered in just about all that area. Now, Section 7, I wanted to briefly talk about some of the articles that I've provided to you. If you look at the, attached to my outline, I've got a couple of articles that have made the newspapers recently. And these all derive out of Section 7. You can see the first article was an Oregonian article. It talks about a bridge in Clackamas County that was being constructed near the Sunnyside Road I-205 interchange, where the federal government stopped the county from continuing work on the bridge because there were fears that the bridge would harm some of the listed species there. And this comes out of Section 7 because the money for this bridge comes from the federal government under the Federal Highway Administration. Therefore, there is a federal nexus. So they can go out and you know, in this case, they changed their minds. At the first point, they said that the work that was going to take place there would be okay and that no jeopardy would come to the species. But then they changed their mind and they said, well, we think that there will be jeopardy. And as a result, work on the bridge stopped.
What's the time element on those two decisions that they have in relationship to the bridge construction?
When were they given the go-ahead, and when did they change their mind?
Right.
Chair Jensen, I'm not quite sure when they were given the go-ahead. I would assume that it was several months back. And then my understanding is they went out there and they inspected the work, and they decided that the work was being done in a manner so that it would cause jeopardy, and then they stopped the work. But I'm not clear on the timelines. I believe there was a span of at least 8 to 10 months.
I think that I don't know, and I know Representative Lee is far more familiar with this than I am, since it's in her district. But I think there's at least something of confusion on my part as to when those authorizations were and what may or may not have transpired in between them. So I thought that's fine.
Well, Chair Jensen, my understanding is NIMS said that they gave approval for one type of construction, but in fact, the county was engaged in another type, and they were concerned that what they were doing was going to cause jeopardy to the species there, so they stopped the work. The county has a different story. They say that they were just doing what they were told to do. And, you know, it's a he said, she said issue. And you know, the bottom line is it's going to cost the county about $8 million to do what NIMS says they have to do now. So it's a real touchy issue for Clackamas County. And the next article that I have in the Oregonian deals picks up the story with that a month later. And now they've got it at $135,000 a month that it's costing the county to deal with this issue. The third article that I have clipped for you is a Wall Street Journal article, and this really, I couldn't believe what I was reading. If you turn to page 2 of 2, this is a Wall Street Journal article that talks about the Washington Department of Transportation, which was trying to build a highway as a bypass to some of the traffic up between Olympia and Bellevue, Washington. And because they needed federal money through the Federal Highway Administration again, there had to be a consultation with NIMS because there were listed species present. And this, you know, the state of Washington had spent a lot of money getting this thing in the works, and they had spent a great deal of time on it with various options. But the National Marine Fisheries Service basically said, we don't care. We don't want you building this highway. And if you look at the third paragraph on page 2, I mean, it really raises some red flags. And I'm quoting Brian Gorman, the National Marine Fisheries Service spokesman, saying, we think our concerns are entirely appropriate. We simply cannot concur with the Department of Transportation's proposals because more roadways permit more growth, and that is not something that is that's something that isn't in the best interest of fish. So what they're doing is they're using Section 7 of the Endangered Species Act to stop growth where they don't think it is advisable. And frankly, I don't think that that is an appropriate function for a federal agency to be doing. Okay, getting back to the outline. Section 7 applies to both threatened and endangered species. This is important. Remember, there is a difference. Federal action that is proposed or being permitted would jeopardize the species, then you need to come up with a reasonable alternative. No jeopardy to the species is allowed except in some very specific circumstances. Section 9 of the Endangered Species Act sets forth the prohibitions which pertain only to endangered species. And this is very important. It doesn't say threatened species, it only says endangered species. And in a nutshell, Section 9 says that no person may take an endangered species. This is the most important section in the Endangered Species Act because take is defined as, quote, harass, harm, pursue, hunt, shoot, wound, kill, trap, capture or collect, or attempt to engage in any such conduct. Well, the agencies have picked up on this term harm and have gone and defined it by administrative rule as arising from significant habitat modification, where that would actually kill or injure protected species by significantly impairing essential behavioral patterns, including breeding, spawning, rearing, migrating, feeding, or sheltering. So what's happened here is the two federal agencies, NIMS and U.S. Fish and Wildlife, have taken the term harm and, you know, transformed it into a definition that basically encompasses anything that's habitat modification. And the sky's the limit. I mean, anything can be habitat modification. Cutting down a single tree could be habitat modification. Building a house could be habitat modification. The sky's the limit. I do want to note that this interpretation was approved by the U.S. Supreme Court in a case that arose here in Oregon. The Sweet Home versus Babbitt case on spotted owls, the United States Supreme Court ruled that that was a reasonable agency interpretation. And so that's the law of the land until Congress or the agencies themselves change it. Section 11 of the Endangered Species Act, this deals with penalties and enforcements. I like to think of Section 11 as the hammer. Civil penalties can range in fines of up to $25,000 for each violation. That's each fish. Criminal violations can range in fines of up to $50,000 in 1 year in a federal penitentiary for each fish. There's no intent to commit a take required for liability, although the penalties will probably be smaller for unintentional takes. Section 11 also has the citizen suits provision, which is a very significant threat to people out there working the land. Due to a lack of enforcement capabilities, the feds will simply be unable to go after all violators, and Congress was aware of this. So they built citizen suit provisions into the act. It's the idea of the citizen attorney general going out and finding violators and suing them. So citizen groups, such as environmentalist groups or anti-growth groups, or just about anybody has standing under the act, can go out, file a lawsuit, and obtain an injunction, and they get their attorney's fees paid if they prevail. So the Endangered Species Act provides them with economic incentive to go out, seek out violators, and file lawsuits against them. I wanted to briefly mention the lower standards for preliminary injunctions under the act. Generally, in federal court, in order to obtain a preliminary injunction, the person asking for it has a very severe proof burden to meet. They've got to prove that they are almost definitely going to win at the end of the lawsuit. They've got to show that when they balance out the equities, the balance clearly falls on their side. And they also have to show irreparable harm to themselves if the injunction was not to issue. Well, the Endangered Species Act throws that paradigm out the window. Extinction is forever, and the courts have said that because extinction is forever, the balance of the equities and the irreparable harm are clearly going to fall on the side of the person asking for the injunction. So in effect, what happens is the people asking for the preliminary injunctions, march in a few expert witnesses that say there's a chance that this development or this whatever may cause harm to the species, and the injunction will issue. I'll give you one example of that. It arises in Tucson, Arizona, where Tucson, Arizona school districts had a problem in that they were running out of space for students. The schools were very overcrowded. So the people passed a bond measure and got some money together, and they were going to build a new elementary school for their kids. And they found a good piece of property. It was a 60-acre tract, and the plan was for them to build a new elementary school there. Well, there was a problem. They found the pygmy owl on the tract. The pygmy owl is a species listed under the Endangered Species Act, but they wanted to preserve the species. They wanted to do everything they possibly could to protect the species. So they decided that they would basically cut the property in half, and they would set aside 30 acres as wildlife refuge. 30 acres would be no touch zone. The other 30 acres would be for the elementary school and the soccer field and the baseball field, etc. Well, it wasn't good enough for the defenders of wildlife, who filed suit. And they filed a lawsuit in federal district court in Arizona, and they got a preliminary injunction. So they stopped the project. Well, they lost. The defenders of wildlife lost. It was shown at the circuit court level that this project would not cause harm to the species, especially since they had proposed carving off this wildlife refuge. But the defenders appealed it, and they took it up to the Ninth Circuit. And they again lost. At the Ninth Circuit, the school district again prevailed, and they were sufficient in showing that they would not cause harm to the species. Well, bottom line is the preliminary injunction was in place for about 7 years, tied up the project for this entire period of time. Not a single piece of dirt was moved during this entire period of time. So 7 years later, the school district was finally able to start building their school. But meanwhile, the kids, were forced to be in overcrowded schools for 7 years. The cost of the project was a lot more expensive after 7 years, and the project had been tied up for this inordinate period of time. Okay, the 4D rule. Hope that's enough background on the Endangered Species Act for today.
You did say that was the Ninth Circuit, didn't you?
That was the Ninth Circuit. Yes, sir.
It must have been pretty clear and convincing case they had.
Not even Ninth Circuit.
Chair Jensen, I'm not going to touch that one with a 10-foot pole. Yes. Okay, the 4D rule for West Coast salmon and steelhead. I've brought a map in for the committee to look at. This is a map that was created by the Oregon Water Resources Department based on NMSA's maps. It was compiled by the department so that you get an idea of what we're dealing with. As you can see, every major population center in the state is covered by this rule, and it's an immense, immense geographic area. NMSA's goal for this rule is to, quote, restore biologically diverse, naturally spawning salmon populations that have a high probability of long-term persistence over a wide range of environments. It's a pretty grand goal. And I want to go back and recap a moment. When I was talking a few moments ago about Section 4D of the Endangered Species Act, I told you that Section 4D requires the Secretary, in this case, Secretary of Commerce, to come up with regulations he deems necessary and advisable for the conservation of the species, because it's a threatened species. 4D says for a threatened species, you need to have 4D regulations. Now, these 4D regulations can take many different forms, and they do. You know, depending on the species that you're dealing with, can determine what the 4D rule is going to look like. But in the case of the West Coast salmon and steelhead, which again are all listed as threatened, all the fish that you see on that map are threatened species, not endangered species, NMFS basically took the most restrictive form that it could, and it applied Section 9 take prohibition to the species. So basically what it did was it said, we're going to treat these fish as if they are endangered. Even though we recognize that they're not, even though we recognize that they're threatened, we're going to just obliterate that distinction and deem them as if they were endangered species and provide them with all of the Section 9 protections that would apply to an endangered species. And I can't tell you how big and how the magnitude of this action. It was huge. It really was. Okay, these fish had been listed as threatened during the latter half of the 1990s, and NMFS used a different approach to list these fish. It used distinct population segments known as evolutionary significant units, or ESUs, and thus you'll see the various ESUs that are under the 4D rule. It didn't do the whole species. It did various ESUs of the species. So, for example, instead of listing all steelhead, NMFS broke steelhead down and listed individual ESUs of steelhead, such as the Lower Columbia River steelhead or the Upper Willamette steelhead or the Snake River Basin steelhead. Now, the final 4D rule applies to 14 different ESUs of these fish in Oregon, Washington, Idaho, and California. If you look at your citizen's guide at page 3, you can see the extent of the rule in the 4-state area. Now, NMFS has stated that it will focus its enforcement of the rule. Remember, enforcing the rule means enforcing the take prohibitions of Section 9. NMFS stated it will focus its enforcement on several categories of activities that it deems the most damaging to the fish. It lists some but not all of these activities on page 5 of your citizen's guide. Now, some of these activities include obvious ones, everybody would agree, such as illegal fishing and discharging raw sewage into fish habitat. But if you take a look at categories I, J, L, and O, it should raise some red flags, because these are otherwise legal land use activities. Conducting timber harvest, grazing, conducting land use activities that may disturb soil, livestock trampling or smothering eggs, shoreline and riparian disturbances. These are all otherwise legal activities that could very well be being conducted pursuant to a land use permit issued by a local government. yet they could end up violating the Endangered Species Act. There's no defense to have a valid land use permit. You could have a land use permit to build your subdivision. If it ends up causing a take of the fish, you've broken the law. All right, I want to talk briefly about the limitations on take. That is what makes this 4D rule so unique. It's an affirmative defense to Section 9 take if the take results from one of the 13 limits on take. Now, in plain English, what does that mean? Well, it means you have a get-out-of-jail-free card, a safe harbor. If you end up taking a fish while acting under one of the 13 limits, then you have not violated the Endangered Species Act. It is an affirmative defense that needs to be raised by the actor. Now, an affirmative defense, we all know that self-defense is an affirmative defense to murder. Well, it's along the same lines as that. An action happens that causes the take of a fish. The person gets sued either by the feds or by a citizens group. Well, they have the burden of raising the affirmative defense that what they did was underneath one of these limitations on take. If you turn to page 8 of the Citizen's Guide, you'll see the limits. They range from page 8 through 19. Now, some of these limits are very specific limits, such as the City of Portland's Park Department's Pest Management Program or the State of Washington's Forest Practices Act. Other limits require individual approval by NIMS, such as fishery management, hatchery programs, or habitat conservation plans. NIMS has stated that it is willing to consider additional limits that are brought before it. Then they recently told Clackamas County that they were not so willing to consider additional limits. So I guess it depends on whichever person at NIMS you talk to. Now I want to focus a little bit on limit number 12. So please turn to page 14 of your Citizen's Guide. Limit number 12 deals with municipal, residential, commercial, and industrial development and redevelopment. Somebody with a sense of humor gave it the acronym of MRCY. I'm sure that some of you heard of the 200-foot riparian setback that made the news when NIMS first proposed the 4D rule. And that requirement comes out of this section. Due to popular outcry, NIMS dropped the 200-foot rule from the final, the 200-foot criterion from the final rule. However, it may be gone, but it sure isn't forgotten, as you will see in a moment. Now, according to limit number 12, development and redevelopment activities, otherwise known as land use activities, which occur pursuant to a NIMS-approved land use program, will be immune from take liability. But the catch is getting NIMS to approve the land use program in a timely manner. To my knowledge, not a single one has been approved. Clackamas County submitted its proposal in July of 2000, and received a notice back in the mail in January of 2001 that the proposal did not meet the requirements for the submittal package and therefore is not considered to be complete. NIMS said that it was missing an effects analysis, which they defined as a scientific analysis of enforcing regs for the benefit of the species. The problem is nobody seems to know what an effects analysis is. NIMS has said we don't know what it is, but we'll sure know it when we see it. So please do it for us, and we'll tell you if it's right. So at this point, I don't know if anybody is going to or how long it will take for any local government to have their land use programs approved by limit number 12. In addition, and this is something that I think the committee would appreciate, the NIMS approval process will require that the land use regulations become federalized. That means that, let's say, when Clackamas County submits its land use ordinance to NIMS for approval, NIMS is required to publish the proposed ordinance in the Federal Register and solicit comments from all over the country. So you will find environmentalists from New York, California, Massachusetts, California, and wherever else arguing that Clackamas County's land use ordinance is not fish-friendly enough. Those groups will now have standing to sue in federal court both against NIMS and Clackamas County, alleging that this rule is not good enough. Now, the criteria that NIMS is going to use to evaluate these local ordinances, as you might imagine, are very restrictive on development. They include avoidance of unstable slopes, wetlands, and areas of high habitat value. Stormwater discharge impacts on water quality and quantity must be prevented by reducing impervious surfaces and maintaining forest cover and natural soils. Riparian areas must be adequately protected around all rivers, estuaries, streams, lakes, deep water habitats, and intermittent streams. And I'm going to return to this, which is arguably the most restrictive criterion, in a minute. Some other criteria: avoidance of stream crossings wherever possible, protection of historic stream meander patterns and channel migration zones. Now, this is an interesting one. Historic stream meander patterns and channel migration zones. Well, Tillamook County, the entire county is a channel migration zone. It floods every spring there. So does that mean that we need to disallow anything in Tillamook County? I don't know. Could very well mean that. We need to avoid stream bank and shoreline hardening. We want adequate protection of wetlands, wetland buffers, and wetland function, including isolated wetlands. There must be adequate preservation of permanent and intermittent streams' ability to pass peak flows. They want to stress landscaping with native vegetation and reduce lawn areas. They want to prevent erosion and runoff both during and after construction. Water supply, they need to ensure water supply can be met without affecting in-stream flows for salmon. Finally, there's got to be mechanisms for monitoring, enforcing, funding, reporting, and implementing the program. Compliance with all other environmental and natural resource laws must be guaranteed. Okay, I want to return to criteria number 3, which is arguably the most restrictive here. Adequate protection of riparian areas. This is how NIMS replaced the 200-foot riparian setback. I want to give you a little history. The 200-foot setback had initially been derived using the logic that a Douglas fir tree can grow to a maximum height of 200 feet. In a pristine Pacific Northwest forest environment, Doug fir trees will be located along all salmon-supporting streams. And now these trees provide shade to keep the streams cool and also provide cover from predators when they fall into the stream after they die. Therefore, NIMS believed that 200 feet should be the buffer zone, with some exceptions, between the edge of the stream and any development activities. Now, this logic is still found in the Citizen's Guide. If you turn to page 15, the bottom of the left-hand column, and I'm quoting the Citizen's Guide now, NIMS determinations are significantly influenced by science indicating that essential habitat functions are affected by varying but significant degrees by streamside activities conducted within a distance equal to the height of the tallest tree that can grow on that site, known as the site potential tree height. The 200-foot riparian setback is still alive, and it is still well. If you turn to the last article that I provided in my packet, this article deals with the City of Portland's attempt to build some mixed-use development in the North McAdam Renewal District. And they had proposed a 100-foot setback from the Willamette River to protect salmon. Well, NIMS said it wasn't good enough. And I'm quoting the middle of the article, the first page of the article, where NIMS spokesman said, quote, "A substantial body of research and experience is accumulating to show that a 200-foot corridor is near the minimum desirable for restoration and maintenance of fish and wildlife habitats." Now the 200-foot setback has become a minimum, folks. Okay, so what does all this mean to land use in the state of Oregon? Well, it means that activities that we've all taken for granted could now result in liability for taking a listed species. I have realtors coming to me all the time saying, what do I advise my clients when they want to do some work that, you know, is within any close proximity to a river, lake, stream, wetland, or just plain water? And I say, well, you probably want to advise them to obtain the services of a fish biologist and at least get the opinion of a professional biologist that the work that they're going to undertake will not cause any harm to these fish. But even that's no guarantee. I mean, all that does is allows the person to rest a little easier, but it's still no defense if they end up getting sued. And this could include anything. I mean, you know, somebody on Johnson Creek in southeast Portland that wants to put a deck on the back of their house could very well end up running afoul of the Endangered Species Act. A homeowner that wants to add a detached garage. I mean, the liability potential is endless under this thing, folks. Okay, also wanted to talk briefly about local governments. Local governments can be found liable for violating the Endangered Species Act merely by issuing a permit under their otherwise legal land use ordinances. There are at least two cases that I know of in which that happened. And I'll give you an example of a case that arose in Florida. Volusia County, Florida, had a subdivision ordinance that required developers to put in streetlights whenever they gave approval for a subdivision. Well, the problem is the loggerhead sea turtle, an endangered species, the females would come on shore and lay their eggs, and then the baby turtles would hatch at night, and then the way that they found their way back to the ocean was they would follow the moon. Well, these streetlights happened to look like the moon, and some of these turtles were turning the wrong way and not making it out to the ocean, and they were dying. So as a result, the local government got sued, as did all the developers, and the court found liability. Nobody got thrown in prison. Nobody paid a fine. But this is precedential authority because the court did require the government, the county government, to go out and change its ordinance based on liability that arose under Section 9 of the Endangered Species Act. There's also a case that arises in Massachusetts, where the Massachusetts Department of Fish and Wildlife was found liable because it was allowing fishermen to use nets to catch fish, but was also catching the right whale, which is an endangered species, so they required the Massachusetts Department of Fish and Wildlife to change its regulations. I'll tell you a real quick funny story on this. I did this presentation on the coast one day with the planning director for the city of Newport, And when he talked about potential liability for local governments, he had a real unique way to avoid it, at least for himself. And he said that from now on, he doesn't sign any permits. He makes his associate planner sign all the permits in the city of Newport. That way he won't be the one that gets thrown in jail. Okay, well, I guess in conclusion, this is a very significant issue for the state of Oregon. I'm sure this committee is aware of the ramifications of it, and it appears to me that it's only going to get worse before it gets better. With that, I would open it up to questions from the committee.
Representative Leonard. Harlan, I appreciate the perspective you bring, and but I have to tell you, I'm just sitting here envisioning the area that I grew up in and still live in. The Columbia Slough has signs posted on it: don't eat the fish, they're contaminated and poisoned. There's Superfund hot sites in the harbor in downtown Portland, all resulting from unregulated activity, probably about 150 years worth. We laugh at regulations that try to limit the greenhouse effect from certain hydrocarbon fuels, which we're going to run out of someday. Nobody wants to talk about that. And it's easy to sit around and make fun of people who want to build a deck or a garage, somehow getting sued. But somewhere in between is where the truth is to this problem. And it doesn't seem to me to be helpful to, you know, for me to sit and say, you know, the city of Portland's allowed to dump raw sewage and anything you can imagine goes into the toilet, ends up in the Willamette River to this day, any more than it makes sense, I think, to argue that some of these regulations just don't make sense. Somewhere in the middle is where I think we're going to have to find ourselves. And because we have done, in some cases, irreparable damage to the environment by not being tough enough on enforcing some of these environmental rules. Is it true some people are overzealous? Yes. Is it also true that some people are exploiting every opportunity they can to minimize their liability and to dump stuff cheap as possible? To this day, and in this session, you'll hear it, the answer is yes. So, I mean, I appreciate some of what you say, but it strikes me as more anecdotal kind of outrageous examples in the light of the kinds of things that others would say on the other side. So, I'm not sure what kind of answers you're providing or solutions. I hear you complaining about the regulations, but it's not helping me try to figure out what we're going to do this session to try to waltz through the various problems to get to a solution to restore salmon.
Chair Jensen, Representative Leonard, I appreciate the comments. You're right, there's got to be some middle ground. I mean, the Endangered Species Act is the single most powerful weapon in the world. It is the most powerful legislation in existence for protecting the environment. And that's a good thing. I mean, there's definitely a need for that. Nobody wants species to go extinct. I mean, biodiversity is important. But the problem is, you know, with that power comes certain responsibilities. And, you know, I gave you a few anecdotes here, but I could, you know, come up with a whole bunch more that would really cause this committee to...
Well, Mr. Chair, I could match you anecdote for anecdote is my point of polluters, not in the past, but today, and the defense people have of that and the arguments for that. And we're going to have legislation for this committee. Well, that is going to be central to the argument on both sides. But my point is that didn't get us anywhere. I mean, if I sit and use those examples and you counter me with your example, where is that in helping us find a solution? And they're just both outrageous examples of things people do to polluters and the things that polluters do to people. I mean, that's, what does that get us?
Thank you.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a question. Thank you for your testimony. I have a question on the municipal liability. Do you think that under this 4D rule that a county could be sued for putting bicycle paths next to riparian zones?
Chair Jensen, Representative Smith, it's possible. If somebody really didn't want the bicycle path to go in, and if they could find a nexus with the bicycle path causing an essential or a significant change in the essential behavioral patterns of the fish that are in that stream, and those fish are listed, then in theory, under the way the law has progressed, yes, absolutely.
Could I do a follow-up?
Please.
And the reason I bring that up is because in East Multnomah County, we have 9 streams that are deemed significant for fish. 3 of those, of the 9, have 300-foot buffers from the center line, plus an additional 150 no-build zone, and they're going to put bicycle paths and impervious surface right in this, you know, next to the stream, within 10 feet. So that was why my question.
I suggest you file a suit.
I just wanted to be clear on it. Thank you.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It would seem to me that if this is a stream where there's endangered species, one couldn't even build the bicycle path without having gotten a permit from takings unless there's a 4D exception. So just the act of constructing it would be illegal.
Representative Jensen, Chair Jensen, Representative Lee, not necessarily. If the permit is issued by the local government, then it's the buyer beware syndrome, where the developer theoretically knows that, you know, there's potential liability there, but he's got a valid permit, and it only becomes a penalty if the ref blows the whistle. So if this developer were to get sued, then, you know, there's proximate cause relationship. There would have to be a showing that this particular development will result in damage to the species, and then, yes, then they would be liable. But permits are going to still be issued, even in light of the fact that not a single one of these limit number 12s have been granted, even though, you know, people are still out there doing development work, but they're being very cautious, and they should be, because, you know, the potential liability is extreme.
May I follow up, Mr. Chair? Then our counties and other local governments providing some kind of warning that that's the case when such permits are provided so that they're not liable?
Chair Jensen, Representative Lee, I don't know if they are or not. I know that some local jurisdictions have very proactive Endangered Species Act departments, the City of Portland, for example, Clackamas County, the City of Salem. I would imagine that those jurisdictions probably would give out some kind of pamphlet or flyer. Other jurisdictions aren't doing anything about this. And, you know, I mean, they could be facing a great deal of potential liability for that reason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry to go on with this. I just have a real quick question on that. I'm not aware that they're issuing a permit. They're doing it as an exemption that they're, because it's a road right away, that they can do that, an exception, or they're exempt from land use laws.
Chair Jensen, Representative Smith, I'm not aware of what that means.
Okay.
You know, it could be, is it, does the county own the land? I mean, what?
They own the road right away.
Okay. Well, then the county is going to be deemed the person that could very well be the actor that, if a take results, would be held liable under the Endangered Species Act.
Thank you.
Other questions?
No.
Just an observation. If I were a young land use lawyer, this would have been the bill that I would have written to provide guaranteed annual income.
Appreciate that, Chair Jensen.
Well, and I hope the committee recognizes a little from this, you know, where the Endangered Species Act goes. I don't think there's anyone on the committee that quarrels or questions with the need to preserve our environment. I don't think anyone questions the fact that we have made mistakes in the past. But whether the current practices are larger mistakes than we've made in the past is something that only history will tell for us. Thank you very much, Mr. Levy. Appreciate it. Very informative discussion on the Endangered Species Act and the poultry rules.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Gavel in now as a full committee. We have a quorum, have had for a little bit. And at this point, we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2224. We'll read the bill and the summary of the bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2224 is deleting the requirement that a person who owns or leases land for 5 years prior to establishing the private hunting preserve. Current law requires that a landowner either own or lease that land for at least 5 years prior to establishing the hunting preserve. The proponents assert that this requirement is somewhat unreasonable and hinders their ability to establish and operate private hunting preserves. We have ODFW here. There he is.
Mr. Elliker.
Mr. Elliker and Eric Roberts.
Eric, this is Rickerson.
For the record, my name is Roy Elliker, legislative coordinator with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. On my right, Eric Rickerson, program leader for the Upland Bird Program. Going to my prepared testimony, Mr. Chair, Basically, there have been issues regarding the legal interpretation of this five-year phraseology for the past several years. It's an old requirement that, as far as we can determine, was present in the law when it first passed in 1973. The department would have no objection, Mr. Chair, for that five-year language to be removed.
Thank you, Roy. You said that it's an old law that goes back to when?
Well, I believe it. If I can remember my legislative history, 1973 is when the law was first passed, Mr. Chair. It may be older than that, but looking at the latest statute book, 73 was the date.
Roy, you understand the things that happened in 1973 would not necessarily, for some of us in this room, be considered old.
I stand corrected, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any questions of the department?
That hardly considered new, Mr. Chair.
But Representative Cruz, there are some of us that would consider it fairly new. Representative Lee.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you have any idea how many more units that would create? Has there been a lot of interest from folks who didn't meet the five-year requirement?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lee, currently we have 59 shooting preserves registered in the state, throughout the state. That's the east and west side. You see slightly different acreage requirements for those. We have several other applications before us, and I know personally of two other potential shooting reserve operators that would probably go ahead and apply if the five-year recommendation or five-year phraseology was removed. We think this will spark further interest in shooting reserves, Representative Lee. We have no way of really knowing just how many more this might spur. We know that there'll be more, however.
Thank you.
Roy, this is confined exclusively to game birds. Is that correct?
Chair Jensen, that is correct.
One of the concerns that I've heard in my part of the state, perhaps about this, is that the nature of doing these sort of things may lead to a lot of the, for lack of a better way to describe them, for an Eastern Oregonian, rich Portland folks coming over and buying a plot of land simply to have a game preserve, taking that land then fundamentally out of production, presenting something of a problem for the neighbors around the land with agricultural activities and farm stock. Have you any experience, as the department, any experience or concerns with that?
Chair Jensen, no, I don't believe so, and I'm not sure I quite understand your question. If the question is the land's going to be taken out of kind of the usual kind of hunting activity that's gone on for generation, where someone would get permission to hunt or allow public to hunt, that's been a concern of some sportsmen. If the concern is that this takes acreage out of farm production, Mr. Chair, I don't have any knowledge that in fact has been the case. I assume that most of these shooting preserves, they're not very large, actually, in terms of overall ranch size or farm size, particularly on the east side. And I assume that most of them actually have agriculture production as part of their overall use of the land.
Well, there seems to be a growing number of, acreages over there where it's just simply a hunting preserve for the owners who do nothing really with the property. And perhaps it's more anecdotal than anything else, and perhaps the 5 years doesn't have any effect one way or another on that. So just was curious if you'd had any complaints or concerns issued or that you're aware of.
None that I'm aware of, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, I guess my sense of that would be if somebody's rich enough to buy land just to hunt birds, the 5 years probably wouldn't make any difference to them. It's obviously, I mean, because I personally can't imagine that kind of disposable income, but I guess one could assume that. I think as far as folks from Portland wanting to come over and shoot birds, I think the folks who do this are depending upon that. That's how they make their money. But
I know we have some farms that, where that is the case, where they do that.
Yeah, but the five-year moratorium hadn't stopped any of that, so.
No.
Yeah.
Maybe from Beaverton.
Corbett. Where the rich live now.
Well, in light of what we heard about today, what Portland does to the river, well, you know.
Well, that's a good point.
Is there any other? Or is there any meaningful discussion? We might get into
it
at this point.
Not yet.
Okay. Did you have anything, Greg, that you were...
I was just here providing some...
You were expert testimony, and you couldn't even answer my question.
I couldn't even provide that. That's what I could just say.
Okay. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2224 and open work session on House Bill 2224.
Chair.
Representative Cruz.
I would move House Bill 2224 to the floor to do pass recommendation.
Representative Cruz moves House Bill 2224 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? The clerk will call a roll.
Aye.
Excuse.
Representative Cruz.
Aye.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Representative Tomei. Excuse. Representative King. Aye. Representative Leonard. Aye. Representative Hayes. Aye. House Bill 2224 has received the appropriate vote and will be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Would we care to have a... Yes, Representative King.
I'd like to move consent calendar for 2224.
Representative King moves the consent calendar for House Bill 2224. What? I don't think she'll have my turn.
Okay.
If someone has a strong wish to take care of that, I would rescind my motion.
I was just thinking that just from reading it, it might raise some, I know for me, just the explanation. Resolve the concerns I had.
I was talking about
somebody else. Yeah.
But I have an objection to that. We would therefore withdraw that motion, Representative King, and.
Well, no, I won't talk about it.
Huh?
Yeah, you should carry it, huh? Yeah.
Okay.
I thought I heard Mr. Representative Leonard volunteer.
I thought I heard. I'll say it's such an easygoing bill. So we ought to be able to explain it.
Representative Morgan might like to carry.
I'd let her carry.
Representative Morgan, there's a possibility, but she hasn't shown up to testify on the bill.
Yes, I believe.
And I think it's a paper.
She is in Subways and Means. We will assign this to Representative Morgan unless she throws it back in our face, in which case we'll come back and assign it to Representative King.
Always glad to volunteer. Good candidates for Senate County.
Close the work session then, or that on House Bill 2224, and open a public hearing on House Bill 2862. Put the rate the bill on the title of it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2862 is creating the Commercial Fisheries Permit Buyback Fund. It specifies that monies obtained from the certain limited entry permit commercial fisheries shall be placed in the fund for payment of monies advanced by the federal government under Fleet Reduction Ground Fish Permit Buyback Program. Declaring an emergency effective on passage, and it also has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Thank you.
Representative Thompson.
Past representative. I'm representing Fishermen's Market Association.
That's it.
At this point, this is a bill that they brought forward in this problem, we believe, or I shouldn't say problem, it is an advantage that we will receive in the next 2 years from the federal government to reduce fishing vessels on this coast. This is an important piece of it because this creates the place where the money can go so that the money doesn't go back into the general fund. That funds will then be transferred back to the federal government for the repayment of a loan from the federal government in the buyback program. Now, the first question that will come to mind is, how much is the repayment going to be? Well, until we know exactly how much money the federal government is going to send to us, how many boats we're going to be able to buy, we can't attach that. All this does is create that spot for that money. If the money doesn't come from the federal government, it doesn't do anything. But we believe that within the next 2 years, that money will flow to this state, and we have to pass that during this session.
Any questions, Terry?
Boy, I'm good. This is the first time I've ever seen a committee without questions on a buyback program in all the years I've been putting these together. Thank you very much.
In light of that, Thompson, how long is it that we've been working on this buyback program?
Well, the concept originally started, I would say, about four years ago as the caps on groundfish started to reduce, and we realized there was concepts even earlier than that, but we really started to push for the idea. The last 2 years, it's even become more important. In fact, we asked for $30 million last session from the federal government, and that money didn't flow, but $5 million worth of emergency funds did flow in for emergency relief to fishermen. Now, there are more and more people aware. Senator Stevens is aware. He's got a problem in Alaska with buybacks in the Apelio fishery and to several other fisheries. So we believe that the money for the West Coast groundfish will get attached onto the major funds from to go to Alaska.
And follow up on that, Terry, I believe we had another bill that prevents the issuance of new permits for the licensing of new boats. Is that correct on that?
Right. That was a bill that I put in. That bill has already moved to the House floor, and what it did was make it so that you could reduce the number of boats, and that the lottery system did not come in and rebuild that number of boats back up to the original level. It was a problem that I had worked on because I created those lotteries years ago. Now there's a group of fishermen who would like to see those lotteries literally removed. In fact, they've contacted me in the Lobby Message Center the other day, and I don't have a problem if they remove them, but it's a lot easier sometimes to make sure that something like just reducing the cap is easier to make than to actually start to reduce boats. So, these all fit together, and there will be some other bills probably in the next session. If this money comes, there'll be several other bills talking about tax issues and how to stimulate buyback to reduce the amount of money that'll have to come from the industry.
I see, and the sponsors of the bill, a generous representation of coastal representatives and senators. So it's reasonable to assume that it's something that others have an interest in then on the coast.
Well, it will affect all the commercial fisheries on the coast in one way or another. And so I went out to collect names. I tried to go to each of the get a representation up and down the coast. Actually, this will represent all of the three western coastal states, and there's this same exact bill or the same type of bill is going to be tried to pass in Washington and California. So it's up and down the whole West Coast. There's about 212 boats involved in the ground fish fishery.
Do we have any idea where those bills are at in the other two states?
I don't think they've moved this far. I think they're in draft in Washington, and I'm not sure the status in California.
What would be the consequence of our passing it and they're not?
Ideally, then all the money would flow to here.
So we should try to encourage them not to pass it then.
Let them make their own decisions how to manage their fisheries. If we're out in advance and we do our job better than them, I'm not against us taking all the money.
I guess my question is that it would not negatively impact us if they did not pass it.
No. It shouldn't anyway. I wouldn't imagine that it would make a difference. It would just that we'd have our everything in place and that we could participate then in either a portion of the money or ideally if it was deemed necessary, a major portion. We have the bulk of the ground fish fisheries in this state. A lot of people aren't aware of that. The Washington fleet is reduced considerably, and there are a lot of vessels in California, but they're mostly small hook and line vessels and would be bought out for very small money. Most of the larger operators are here and then in Crescent City in Eureka, California. In fact, a lot of the California fleet comes from Oregon and fishes down there in the winter.
Thank you. Roy Ellicker, I'm the Department of Fish and Wildlife.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. We'll probably be for the record, Roy Ellicker, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, Legislative Coordinator, again, to the bill. We support the bill, Mr. Chair. We'll be handing in some written testimony probably tomorrow, but Kay Brown was sick today. I'm kind of filling in for her. She has testimony with her. However, it's just like Representative Thompson spoke. We need to have this account set up, as I understand it, to allow the commercial ground fish buyout to occur. So we support the bill.
Questions of the department? Roy, is it imperative that we have Ms. Brown's testimony before we pass this bill?
Mr. Chair, no, it's not.
We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2862 and open the work session on House Bill 2862.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2862 to the Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Cruz moves House Bill 2862 to the Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Cruz?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative
Aye.
No. Oh, excuse me. Yes.
Aye.
Aye.
House Bill 2862 is passed and moved to the Ways and Means Committee on Ways. This time we'll close that public hearing and we'll open a work session on House Bill 2163.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, 2163 is back before us for a work session. Attached, you will find a hand-engrossed version of the bill with the Dash 1 amendments. The Dash 1 amendments were brought to the committee in concept form from the Department of Forestry on the meeting on January 22nd. They are here to address any questions, but I will do my best to give you a quick scope on it. It adds the word harvest for clarification after the type 2 and type 3 references throughout the bill. It's also removing the language conducting the harvest to not restrict the operator in just those capacities. So through the bill, you'll see that deleted. The addition of section 2. That is a housekeeping correction. In current statute, there is reference to a statute that has been repealed. Legislative Council is just adding this language to make the current law more forthcoming and direct. The department is fine with these amendments. I believe the industry is okay with these amendments. If you have any question, they are here to answer any specifics that you may have. Oh, and also we have received written testimony a couple of times from Pacific Rivers Council. So this is the facts I received from them this morning. They are raising some issues for your awareness.
President King.
No, I wasn't aware that they were raising issues here.
Pardon me?
I wasn't aware that they were raising issues.
I thought you had a question. Right?
No, I was signaling something else there. Thanks for the notice.
Chair? I move the -1 amendments to House Bill 2163.
Representative Cruz moves the - amendments to House Bill 2163. Is there discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Representative Cruz?
Aye.
Representative
Smith? Aye.
Representative Horn?
Aye.
Yeah, Representative
King?
Aye.
Representative Lee?
Aye.
Jerry Jensen?
Aye.
I wasn't called.
Representative
Smith. Okay, aye.
The -1 amendments have been moved to House Bill 2163.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2163 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Cruz moves House Bill 2163 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Mr. Chair?
Discussion?
Yes. Mr. Chair. I'm just interested in the material that we just received. Mm-hmm. Has anybody had a chance to look at this thoroughly enough to know what we requested in here is to hold off on passing this until it's time for further analysis? Is that something that we should consider?
Representative Tomei, this legislation came to us, as you will recall, from a work group that had been in meeting during the interim. And I see right here, would you care to come up, please, and give us a little bit of, history and background on that again to refresh our memory?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ray Wilkerson, Oregon Forest Industries Council. To speak specifically to the letter or whatever it was you just got today, this piece of legislation is a recommendation from the Forest Practices Advisory Committee, which was appointed by the Board of Forestry and met for over 2 years in innumerable meetings to develop recommendations on upgrading the forest practices rules. This is an example of that. This does upgrade the forest practices rules. There was 4 environmental groups who were members of that work group, and in the end, 2 of those environmental groups supported the package, 2 did not. One of the ones that did not was the Pacific Rivers Council, but their point of view was thoroughly discussed in the advisory committee process for over a 2-year period on this and other issues, and the ultimate endorsement of this package by the Forest Practice Advisory Committee was overwhelmingly on the positive side. So we unfortunately didn't please everybody, but almost everybody from a very diverse group of people that worked on that issue. And again, this bill will upgrade the protection of fish and water quality on forest land. We're not going backwards here, in other words.
Can I go ahead, Representative Lee?
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Ray, it appears on the communication from Pacific Rivers Council that Peter Green in the governor's office was also in this task force, or am I?
Representative Lee, he was not on the task force. He monitored it and attended most of the meetings, but he was not a member.
So the governor's office was fully aware of the outcome of this?
Absolutely, Representative Lee. The governor himself participated in this advisory committee process at least 3 times that I can remember. So he was personally engaged and quite pleased with the outcome.
Thank you.
Representative King.
Well, I noticed on the memorandum, he's just carbon copied on, you know, on this. It just says we sent a copy of this to him, as was that reference.
Ray, if I recall your first testimony correctly, you were indicating that this was a an illustration of the Oregon plan at work. Could you elaborate on that again? Maybe correct me if I'm wrong in the way I...
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. I think that was part of the history of how the Oregon plan was first before this legislature two sessions ago in the 97th session. And we were trying to avoid a coho listing at that time. And part of the way we did that, at least temporarily, was to enter into a memorandum of agreement with the National Marine Fisheries Service that was signed by Governor Kitzhaber and the Secretary of Commerce. And one of the elements in there was a direction to the Board of Forestry to review the forest practices rules to determine if improvements were needed in those rules. So that's the loop back to the Oregon plan that this bill represents.
Any other questions, Mr. Welch? Thank you, Ray.
Thank you.
Colleagues, one of the reasons that we've been a little slow bringing this back to the committee was Representative Morgan had some concerns with it, and particularly concerns with the small woodland owners. So we told Representative Morgan that we were concerned about that, and we wanted to have that answer before we moved ahead with it in this committee. She got back to me that she had contacted a group of them, and they had gotten back to her, and they were okay with the bill as written, as amended. So. Any other questions?
Okay.
Clerk will call a roll. Passed, and Representative King will carry the bill. Work session on 2163 is closed. And
Representative Jensen, can we show Vice Chair Leonard and Representative Knopf as you?
They are shown.
Yes. Okay.
Yes. Any other business for the good of the committee?
Whatever.
Hearing none, we're adjourned.